The Caliphate Abdullahi had assembled all his army at Omdurman. They numbered almost 100,000. Abdullahi reviewed them before the city on the wide plain below the Kareri Hills. The prophecy of one of the saintly mullahs on his deathbed was that a great battle would be fought upon the hills that would define the future of Mahdism and the land of Sudan. Anyone looking upon the mighty dervish array could not doubt the outcome of the battle. The galloping regiments were strung out over 4 miles, wave after wave of horsemen and massed black Sudanese spearmen. At the climax of the review, Abdullahi addressed them passionately. He charged them in the name of Allah and the Mahdi to do their duty. "Before God, I swear to you that I will be in the forefront of the battle." The threat that the emirs and caliphs feared above all others was that presented by the gunboats. Their spies had reported the power of these vessels to them. Abdullah had devised a counter to this menace. Among his European captives still in Omdurman was an old German engineer. Abdullah had him brought before him, and his chains were struck off. This was usually the prelude to execution, and the German was prostrated with terror. "I want you to build me explosive mines to lay in the river," Abdullahi told him. The old engineer was delighted to have this reprieve. He flung himself into the project with enthusiasm and energy. He filled 2 steel boilers, each with 1,000 pounds of gunpowder. As a detonator, he fixed in them a loaded, cocked and charged pistol. To the pistol's triggers, he attached a length of stout line. A firm tug on this would fire the pistol, and the discharge would ignite the explosive contents of the boiler. The first massive mine was loaded onto one of the dervish steamers, the Ismailia. With the German engineer and 150 men on board, it was taken out into mid-channel and lowered over the side. As it touched the bottom of the river, the steamer's captain, for reasons he never had an opportunity to explain, decided to yank the trigger cord. The efficacy of the mine was demonstrated convincingly to Abdullahi, his emirs and commanders, who were watching from the shore. The Ismailia, with her captain, crew, and the German engineer, was blown out of the water. Once Abdullahi had recovered from the mild concussion induced by the explosion, he was delighted with his new weapon. He ordered the captain of one of the other steamers to place the second mine in the channel. This worthy had been as impressed as everybody else with the first demonstration. Wisely, he took the precaution of flooding the mine with water before he took it on board. The mine, rendered harmless, was then laid in the channel of the Nile without further mishap. Abdullahi praised him effusively and showered him with rewards. The dervish commanders waited for the infidel to come. Each day their spies brought reports of the slow but relentless approach. Better than anyone, Osman Atalan understood the strength and determination of these stern New Age crusaders. When the infidel advance reached Mere, only 4 miles beyond the Kareri Hills, he rode out with Al-Nur and Muman Digna and gazed down from the heights upon the host. Through the dust they raised, he saw the marching columns, the lance heads of the cavalry glittering in the sunlight. He watched the heliographs flashing messages he could not understand. Then he gazed at the flotilla of gunboats, beautiful and deadly, coming up the flow of the Nile. He rode back to his palace in Omdurman and called for his wives. "I am sending you with all the children to the mosque at the oasis of Gedda. You will wait for me there. When the battle is won, I will come to find you." Rebecca and Nazira packed their possessions onto the camels, gathered up the 3 children, and, under an escort of Agajiers, left the town. "Why do these infidels wish to hurt us?" Ahmed asked pitifully. "What shall we do if they kill our exalted and beloved father?" Ahmed lacked the fine looks of his parents. His eyes were blue, but close-set and furtive. His front teeth protruded beyond his upper lip. This gave him the appearance of a large ginger rodent. "Do not snivel, my brother. Whatever Allah decrees, we must be brave and take care of our honoured mother," Karuba answered. Rebecca felt her heart squeeze. They were so different. Ahmed, plain-featured, timid and afraid. Karuba, beautiful, fearless and wild. She hugged the infant to her breast as she swayed on the camel saddle. Under the cotton sheet she had spread over her to protect her from the sun, Her baby daughter lay listlessly against her bosom. The tiny body was hot and sweaty with the fever that consumed her. Omdurman was a plague city. The little caravan of women and children reached the oasis an hour after dark. "You will like it here," Rebecca told Ahmed. "This is where you were born. The mullahs are learned and wise. They'll instruct you in many things." Ahmed was a born scholar, hungry for knowledge. She did not bother to try to influence Karuba. She was her own soul, and not amenable to any views that did not coincide with her own. That night, as she lay on the narrow Angareb, holding her sick baby, Rebecca's mind turned to the twins. This had happened more often recently, ever since she had known that the Egyptian army was moving irresistibly southwards down the river towards them. It was many years since she had parted from Amber, even longer since Saffron had run off through the dark streets of Khartoum. She still had a vivid picture of them in her mind. Her eyes stung with tears. What did they look like now? Were they married? Did they have children of their own? Were they even alive? Of course they would not recognize her. She knew she had become an Arab wife, drawn and haggard with childbirth, drab and aged with care. She sighed with regret, and the infant whimpered. Rebecca forced herself to remain still to allow her baby to rest. She was seized with a strange, unfocused terror for what the next few days would bring. She had a premonition of disaster. The existence to which she had become inured, the world to which she now belonged, would be shattered, her husband dead, and perhaps her children also. What was there still to hope for? What was there still to be endured? At last, she fell into a dark, numbed sleep. When she awoke, the infant in her arms was cold and dead. Despair filled her soul.